Welcome to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody, your host, sometimes published author, and full-time runner of a show I call The Best Damn Trivia in Montreal. You can find me every Sunday night at 8 p.m. at a place called Grumpy's Bar in downtown Montreal. There, I'll be asking some of the silliest trivia questions you've ever heard and playing an extended round of our audience favorite game, Name That Tune. There are tons of prizes given out, and the whole event is free. Come check us out. It's every Sunday at 8 p.m. at Grumpy's Bar. My guest today is Matthew Bogart, a professional cartoonist who makes Slice of Life comics out in Portland, Oregon. His 2014 graphic novel, The Chair's Hiatus, easily ranks as one of my favorite works of literature of the last decade. As for what it's about, The Chair's Hiatus is a portrait of a musician who's lost both her music and herself, and the quiet journey back to understanding. More recently, Matthew has been producing a new book called Incredible Doom. Incredible Doom is described as an intimate, harrowing comic series about teenagers discovering community through the wild, dangerous days of BBSs and the 90s internet. The collected Volume 1 and Volume 2 of Incredible Doom are now available. And what more can I say than, so far, so good. I'm really enjoying this book and can't wait to read more. Matthew, welcome to Cinema Smackdown.
Thank you so much for having me. What an intro. Wow. That's amazing. One of the your favorite works of literature ever? That's a...
Well, I said it in the last 10 years, but it definitely does rank in the ever pile. I do absolutely love it. And since you continued on the subject, I just wanted to point out one thing about The Chair's Hiatus. I read it digitally online, where it is still available to be read, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thechairshiatus.com. Sure.
And when I looked you up, I realized you were offering hardcover copies of the book, and I barely buy anything anymore in terms of physical media. But I had a girlfriend. I really wanted her to read the book, and it seemed like the perfect gift. So I ordered two copies from you, and they were very reasonably priced. And when they arrived, you had done two hand-drawn drawings in the inside cover of each book, which blew me away.
Well, of course, like that's the benefit of being the person that draws the comics is like, I was just doing this last night. Like, we had a book event for the launch of Incredible Doom Volume 2, and it was at a bookstore, and they had a big stack of Volume 2, and they asked if we wanted to sign these, and you know, like, and of course we did. And I was like, you know, I should draw sketches in all of these. And I was exhausted and my back hurt, and like, I wanted to go to bed, and it took like an hour and a half to draw sketches in all of them. But as I was doing it, I was thinking like, this could be so exciting for someone to discover, like to get as a gift or to get for themselves. And I was like, and what possible better thing do I have to do with my time than like maybe make someone really excited for just like an hour of work? I don't know. Like, I want to do that in every book that I ever sell.
I agree. I totally understand. If you just a slight sidetrack, if you ever want to cut down your time on this, I met Paul Chadwick, creator of Concrete, mm-hmm. way back in the day when he was still publishing Concrete. And when people would bring him copies of the books to sign, he had a 30-second drawing that he would repeat, which was mm-hmm. a square with a big circle in it, which was essentially Concrete's head. And then mm-hmm. he would do a distant background shot, like a... it was like the receding train tracks kind of thing, just to give the whole thing some perspective, and a sun in the top. And it was very rudimentary and brilliant. And I watched him draw that same drawing 12 times in a row in a few minutes.
Yeah.
And it still felt special.
Yeah.
That was what I liked about it.
Yeah, for sure.
But I totally understand what you're talking about. You know, we're super sidetracked on our actual reason for talking today. So let's get into that. Matthew, I invited you on the show today because you have a book coming out, Incredible Doom Volume 2, and your series Incredible Doom, when I read it, it definitely made me wonder what your influences were. And because I host a movie talk show, I reached out to you and said, Matthew, do you have movie influences throughout your life that might have influenced the telling of this story? And you wrote me back and you said you did. So let's talk about a few of them.
Great. Sounds great.
Let's start anywhere you like. What movies have influenced you on this series and others?
Well, The things that I did the most thinking about in order to get ready for this show were the stuff that influenced this series, influenced Incredible Doom, which I do, I should mention, which I do with a collaborator. I plot the story with my friend Jesse Holden. And then once we've broken down what the story will be, I take that plot away and write the script and then draw the book. So these are, to be clear, like my influences on Incredible Doom. Jesse has his own set. But before Jesse came on board, there was a movie at the heart of what sort of got me up off the sofa and made me think like, ooh, I think I have an idea for a comic book, which was, it was a combination of two things. One, I had just recently reread one of my favorite comics, which was Stray Bullets, and had just finished watching Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom. And like so often happens when I watch a movie that really sort of grabs me for whatever reason, like the end, as soon as the end credits happen, I'm filled with this urge of like, I need to suddenly make 20 comics in the next 2 hours. Like I need to figure out how to get all of this creative energy out of myself. And that happened just after I finished Moonrise Kingdom. And something about having seen that and having just read Stray Bullets, which both involve to some degree two kids, two young adults that run away from home, really got my engine going. And I started trying to figure out how I might be able to mix, like, is it possible to mix the feeling of these two characters that run away from home in Stray Bullets, which is a very sort of violent, in a way, angsty, almost Pulp Fiction-esque crime series, and these two characters that run away from home in Moonrise Kingdom, which is not that, which is very sort of innocent and almost like a fairy tale. And could you combine those two things? Could you have these two characters that were so enamored with each other that they couldn't help but drop everything to be together in this sort of storybook way that comes out of Moonrise Kingdom, but have it exist in a world with stakes like Stray Bullets, where there are, you feel like there is this presence of actual physical, maybe even violent danger sort of looming on the outskirts of things. And that's what got my engine going. How much the finished product ended up like that, it's difficult to say. It's not quite as violent. It's not really terribly violent at all, the book I ended up making. And it's not really as storybook as Moonrise Kingdom. But that's what started me down this process and started making me think about, well, who would these kids be? And how might a story like that combines these two things unfold? And what would it have in it? There's a movie right at the heart of this project, right at the moment of inception.
Well, I could certainly see where I would say the more recent Stray Bullets, the last 6 years or so of that book, could have quite an influence on it, because it is mainly focused on a pair of doomed lovers, a guy and a girl who meet up. I think it's Sunshine and Roses, the series, something like that. Mm-hmm. The long running recent series, which is essentially all one story of Stray Bullets. I would have never thought of it compared to your work, but now that I think about just the road movie aspect and the constant flux of characters in a version of danger, his are very much in danger, while yours are just in an uncomfortable level of, I'll say, life and somewhat danger. And Wes Anderson, I absolutely understand ending a Wes Anderson movie and saying, I need to create something. Moonrise Kingdom is not the one that I quite like that movie, but it is not the one that I ended on thinking I need to create something. I like a lot of his movies, but the magic one for me that isn't for everybody. And I will also say that I saw this movie in the cinema, and seeing it at home, it had a very different impact. It was much smaller at home. And I mean that figuratively as well as literally, is the Darjeeling Limited, which has puppets and claymation animals in it. In an otherwise sort of straightforward, it's a humorous film, but there's a lot of drama in it. And then they talk about an animal and you see the animal and it is clearly not real. And it all culminates in a scene on a train at the end where we revisit all of the main characters of the film as though each of them is in a compartment on a train in a very surreal moment. And when they come to the final image of an, I don't want to spoil it, but there is an animal in that sequence. And I was moved practically to tears by just how brilliantly that was done. And I saw that in the cinema on a giant screen, and it was very stark and beautiful. And I watched it on television at home and thought, it's really hard to see what I saw then. And I feel bad for an audience who saw it, you know, on a phone, for instance.
Yeah.
It was such a beautiful image of that puppet animal. At any rate, just as a comparison to yours, I did love Moonrise Kingdom, which, by the way, is, I've looked through his filmography, despite 40 or so movies after this, it is the final real Bruce Willis movie.
I was just thinking that this morning. I literally did that this morning. I went through and said, is this the is this my last favorite, like the last Bruce Willis movie that I've come out of and thought, wow, I really love that. Looper came out the same year, and I've got a soft spot for a lot of parts of Looper. So it's difficult to say whether, I'm not sure whether this one or Looper was technically which was first and which was second, but it's one of those that's the last Bruce Willis movie that'll I'll get to come out of the theater and say, gosh, he did a bunch of bad ones, but this one's great.
Yeah. Well, it's after those two films, or after that year, it begins the string of what I jokingly called his phoned in performances, of which he started doing 2-day movies where he would literally only go to a set for 2 days and they would shoot him for two straight days and then cut that into an otherwise terrible crime film, many of which are literally him sitting at a desk answering a phone over and over and over. Huh. So the ultimate phoned in performance. We now know Bruce Willis was going downhill in terms of health, and it makes a lot more sense. But the his role in Moonrise Kingdom is so technically perfect, as well as being a real piece of acting. It's the one that you can really point to and say, yep, it should have stopped there, Bruce. Yeah. But I did love him for decades. Last Boy Scout, which is a trash film, is so on the top of my most beloved guilty pleasure movies, if nothing else. What about yourself? Just give me one Bruce Willis movie that would be a favorite or a guilty pleasure. Just for fun.
Oh God, it's so trite, but I've fallen asleep watching Die Hard during the pandemic so many times, partially because it's a movie that I just don't have any problem rewatching, and partially because it's a movie that I've seen so many times that I don't have any problem falling asleep to. But I mean, you know, that's a pretty shocking performance in a pretty wonderful movie, and a side of Bruce Willis that we didn't see much of later in life, where he's so charming and fun. And I kind of miss that.
Welcome back to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody, and I'm joined today by cartoonist Matthew Bogart. His new book, well, his second volume of his book, Incredible Doom, is now available as of just a few days ago of this recording. Matthew, before the break, we were talking about movies and things that influenced ideas and moods and tone of your current book. We previously spoke about Moonrise Kingdom and a comic book called Stray Bullets and a few other side things, but we didn't get too far. So let's continue on. Matthew, tell me another thing that influenced the creation and ideas behind Incredible Doom.
Sure. Well, one of the things that was a challenge when writing this series was it centers around a group of kids in the mid-90s who were some of the first people to build their lives on the early internet. And although I was a teenager in the mid-90s, I wasn't particularly online. So I had to research what this was like. I was just vaguely aware that there was something exciting about the people that I knew back then that were into computers, and I wanted to figure out what it was. And so there were two documentaries, among lots of other things, but two documentaries that really sort of helped inform what this book became and what the interests of these characters were And one was Homepage, which just recently, just in the last year, became available again. It was unavailable for years and years. And I had a friend that gave me a copy that fell off the back of a truck. And about a character named Justin Hall, a kid named Justin Hall, who was espousing the virtues of having your own web page back before practically anyone had it. He described it as like when you could read the entire internet in a long weekend. And then the other was a documentary series. It's like a series of shorts. It's like 6 hours worth of shorts on different subjects revolving around the early internet called BBS, the documentary by Jason Scott. And both of these were so valuable for different reasons, because I think when people picture the early internet, they think of like Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg or one of these people that grew into be like a tech giant. But in actuality, it was built by just teenagers that weren't trying to form some sort of media empire. They were just trying to find their people, you know, because like when you're a teenager, everyone's telling you what to think and everyone's telling you what you should care about. But at the same time, you virtually understand no one around you, and it's clear that none of them understand you. And so you become so desperate to find anybody else that feels the same way that you do. And a certain section of teenagers in the 90s figured out how to hack these glorified calculators, like these business machines, and make them talk to each other and make them help them find their communities, find their people, like comic book communities or queer communities or like exotic fish breeding communities, just like anybody that would help make them feel a little bit less alone.
And as always, the early adopters, the Star Trek boards.
Yes, yes. Which I would be unfaithful to the time if there weren't a couple people that were into Star Trek in Incredible Doom. But it wasn't just like what you think of as tech nerds. You know, there a lot of people think of as like a lot of cis white teenage boys that were trying to find people to play video games with. In actuality, it was the whole spectrum of humanity all trying to experiment with this to find their place. And Homepage is, although it's a flawed movie, a flawed documentary, it's reasonably entertaining, and it's such a glimpse into the sort of utopian idea that a lot of these kids thought they had stumbled onto. And then BBS, the documentary, which is available on YouTube and the Internet Archive, it's less of a narrative film and more of just an attempt to document this time before it disappeared, like interview all the people involved before they got too old to tell their stories. But it's full of little nuggets that I never would have imagined were present in something that felt so technical and nerdy, such like human and stories. And it's just fascinating to me.
If you don't mind me asking, and you may not have an answer for this, do you know what it was that sparked your interest in telling this super long form story that did sort of start its spark in this early BBS adopters? Because I just reread the graphic novel, and my thought was, I have no interest in early BBS stuff, and yet it's the subject I didn't know I needed. It's just like any great piece of literature or film. Sometimes the idea is so, well, why would you ever tell a story about this? And then they make you care. A Little Miss Sunshine is a good example of that. I do not want to watch a movie about child pageants. Oh, mm-hmm. I guess I did. Just as a random example, what was it that sparked the BBS phenomenon for you, if you even know?
Well, there's the practical aspect of just like, how do you get ideas? And then the creative aspect, which is like, how do you know which ones to pursue? And the practical part of it was it goes back to Stray Bullets and Moonrise Kingdom. Like, I was looking at these two things and trying to figure out what aspects of them I liked so much. And in Stray Bullets, it's a period piece that takes place in the 70s, which I believe is when the creator was a teenager. So he's telling stories about teenagers from the time he was a teenager. And I thought, okay, well, what happened in my teenage years in the 90s that might be interesting? And I remembered some kids at school that seemed to have stumbled upon something in computers that I didn't understand. And I thought, oh, in retrospect, this was going to be huge, you know, the internet, but I didn't know it at the time. There's something there. And I started pulling on that thread. The creative part of it that made me think, ooh, this is actually a great world to set this story in, was it's such a bomb thrown into what is already a complex time in people's lives, which is adolescence. Like, I love telling stories about teenagers because everything is so important. You know, losing a friend is just crushing. Something is, you know, minor is like an adult that has a friend that drifts away from them is like, oh, that's too bad. But if a teenager starts losing a friend, it can be devastating to their world. So everything is so heightened in the drama, and it's so much easier to find moments that can really get a reader like wrapped up in the story. And then if you throw the early internet into this, which to this day, I would say most of us still have trouble knowing how to navigate. Mm-hmm. But if with these kids that it didn't even exist before, when, you know, 5 years before when they were in middle school, like them trying to, like bulls in china shops, trying to fumble their way through figuring out how social interactions worked in this new world, had the opportunity to just blow up so many different narratives in such interesting ways that I thought you could end up with some really good character moments that can make people laugh and cry and get excited. And it just seems so rich.
Well, your instincts paid off, because I agree. I'm pretty sucked into that story. Damn you. It is funny, though, you mentioned that teenagers are fascinating to you at the moment. What's really interesting to me is hearing creators talk about what periods they want to talk about, not necessarily years, but their own look back at things. And I remember reading an interview years and years ago with Peter Bagg, who is a creator of Hate and Buddy mm-hmm. Bradley. And he mm-hmm. said every story he told was about himself 10 years earlier. So every time he would embark on something new, it was always the 10 years ago version of him, which explained how the early Buddy Bradley stories, he's quite young and then he matures. So if Buddy is 18 in the book, Bag was probably 28. And if Buddy was 25, he was probably 35. And this has mm-hmm. gone on to the point over the decades where he was telling Buddy Bradley stories, I think into his early 40s. And it's just interesting to look back at what is it you now have a window to look back on. With some version of hindsight, you can say, oh, I see it all now. It's not just the emotions. It's also mm-hmm. the time that has passed that has allowed me to see this in a different light. But yeah, you make an excellent point about how with teenagers, everything is important.
And it is genuinely, like, I don't mean that as like, oh, those dumb kids, they think this was important. It's genuinely like, has enormous impact on their day-to-day lives, how they handle these complex social interactions. It's so exciting a playground to play in as a storyteller.
Well, the heightened element certainly makes sense. And speaking of heightened elements, I took a peek at your list, and I know what your next movie you wanted to talk about was, and it is definitely young people in heightened situations. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what influenced you about the movie Go?
So I actually hadn't watched this in quite a while. I was mostly just going off of memory when this would influence the book. I bought it right before this call just to remind myself, like, am I going to make a fool out of myself by praising this movie? And I watched the first few minutes of it. And at least based on the first few minutes, I'm like, oh no, this is great. I love this. At least for me, I was like, this is still paying off. It's a movie about, it's very sort of 90s in its tone. It's like Pulp Fiction. It jumps around from various different stories that all sort of revolve around a similar set of characters. And there's danger and a drug deal that goes poorly and a lot of 90s tropes. but it moves so fast that you can't, at least I can't help but get wrapped up in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the, I noticed today, like in the first 8 minutes, you've met like 9 of the principal characters that you're going to meet. You get a sense of who all of them are and you want to know more about all of them. It's, I'm actually kind of looking forward to going back and finishing it after the call. But the thing that made me think about Go while working on Incredible Doom was a similar thing that reason that I had a couple other movies on my list, like Don't Think Twice by Mike Birbiglia and Kids, was these sort of ensemble casts of characters and how to tell a story that weaves all of them together in a relevant way. And sort of in particular with Go and Kids, kind of jumps from one narrative to another and back again and so forth, which is what Incredible Doom does. It focuses on like 4 different kids and they each have their own story that we're telling about them. And then they sort of intersect and interweave in interesting ways. And Go, I thought, was a really good example of that and does some really interesting things, surprises of watching a scene one way and then coming back to it with from a different character's perspective with different knowledge and having it really feel rich and rewarding seeing a scene a second time.
All right. Well, I'm going to remind the listener you're tuned in to CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody. I'm joined today by Matthew Bogart, author of The Chair's Hiatus, and more recently, Incredible Doom, a 2-volume series. Matthew, is there going to be a volume 3 of Incredible Doom?
At the moment, we don't have any plans for it.
Okay.
When we finished volume 1, we had all kinds of other stories that we wanted to tell, and we figured out a way to include all of those in volume 2. All of our favorites. So we would, I love these characters. I'd love to come back and do more, but at the moment we're resetting and sort of just being satisfied that we accomplished all the things we set out to accomplish.
Would you like to do a little shout out to your publisher and where we can find this book?
Sure. It's put out by Harper Alley, which is a division of HarperCollins. So you can get it in most places. You can get it, Barnes and Noble or, you know, preferably, a local bookstore is a great place to shop, but Amazon and virtually anywhere.
Perfect. All right. So we were talking about before the station ID, we were talking about the movie Go and the way that it might have influenced you. And I find it fascinating that you only have this vague memory of the movie from a previous viewing. I saw Go in the cinema in 1999 in an absolutely empty room. I think it was myself, my girlfriend at the time, and a screen. And I was blown away by the movie, I remember. As I've rewatched the movie over and over during the last 23 years, believe it or not, I have come to regard it as one of my favorite movies. It's in my top 50, probably.
And that's great.
What can I say about it? It's kind of this perfect storm movie, because if you research it a little bit, you realize by reading a little bit what the writer has to say, it was designed as a short film, only featuring the story about the Sarah Pauly character, who is sort of weird. There's no real lead in this movie, but there are multiple leads. And they really only designed it to be that. And then he decided to start adding to the story and figure out where other characters ended up and how things worked. Now, I will say this one more thing about the structure of Go is that it feels very improvisational in a writing sense of, well, I wonder where it'll go now. And then things sort of magically come together in places where you wouldn't normally expect them to in a standard movie. And I think it was basically a perfect accident in a lot of cases. And one of the reasons I mention this is because if you watch the DVD of Go from way back when, they include deleted scenes, including a deleted entire sequence of the third act, which has a completely different resolution, which is much more mainstream. There's a moment near the end of the film where two characters are, I'm not going to spoil anything, but where two characters are in a bad position where people have guns on them. And the movie as it exists has the most eloquent, beautiful solution to this problem. It is one of the most satisfying moments in any movie I have ever seen, because it goes the opposite way every other movie does. And if you watch the deleted scenes, they did in fact write and film the most standard fight scene you've ever seen.
I had completely forgotten about that.
Super disappointing when you see that sequence. You just go, oh, so basically every movie.
But it's kind of a triumph in that it is a deleted scene and didn't end up, like, someone had the good sense to say, you know what, let's do this again and make this better. You know,
that's why I say the movie has a strange improvisational spirit to it. And those little flourishes that I think came out of moments as they were making it or somehow the writer deciding to expand an existing piece, he found just this handful of magic. That movie really, really works for me. I just wanted to say one more thing. Go does, in fact, have a nonlinear structure somewhat like Pulp Fiction. So whenever I bring up a movie like Pulp Fiction, because it became a standard of storytelling, I really love to shout out one other movie that I think doesn't have anywhere near the level of love it should. It is a 2009 movie called Fish Story. Fish Story is a Japanese film by Yoshihiro Nakamura. It is largely unknown in North America, and it is a non-linear structured story about, I don't quite know how to describe it, but it is a lot of different people throughout decades and decades, all being influenced by a single Japanese punk rock song. And that song might, if things go well, save the world. And as ridiculous as that sounds, when you see how the movie puts all of these plot points together, it is one of my truly favorite movies. If you like Pulp Fiction and you like what the structure is, I would say this movie wildly outdoes it. So that's my challenge to you. You love Pulp Fiction? Watch Fish Story.
I literally just added it to my list while you were talking.
Yeah, Fish Story, 2009, director Yoshihiro Nakamura. I love to shout these things out for anybody who might not know and is looking for a good recommendation. You brought up Don't Think Twice. Now, I would like to know a little more about how that movie impacted you in terms of influencing you on your current work. If you have anything to say about it.
Yeah, for sure. So Don't Think Twice, it's a movie by Mike Birbiglia, who is a stand-up comedian or storyteller that often puts on one-man shows that I think are often very funny and moving. But he's also written and directed a couple of movies, including Don't Think Twice.
And Sleepwalk With Me is the big one. Mm-hmm. That was his breakthrough. Sorry, I just want to get that in.
Yeah. Go ahead. And it's Don't Think Twice is a movie about an ensemble of improv players and doing improv in a theater, the sort of thing where you know the audience gives you a prompt and then you improvise a comedy scene based on it, which is an art form that is sort of perpetually struggling. It's very difficult to have a thriving, commercially successful improv group. So these folks are mostly doing it for the love of it. The thing that it caused me to come back to it over and over again while working on Incredible Doom was a few things. One is how this ensemble very clearly like loves each other and very clearly wants what's best for everyone, but also has each individual character has their own lives and their own needs, and how frustrating it can be when those things can conflict and you want something different than someone that you care a lot about wants. And I love that kind of dynamic between people that you feel like really genuinely are there for each other in moving and important ways. And the other is I would routinely go to this movie and try to break it down. I would I sometimes do an exercise where I will write down the beats of a movie and figure out what important story element, every important story element in order, and then replace the characters' names with my characters' names and try to imagine, okay, knowing my characters, how would they navigate this situation? and very quickly end up with a totally different structure of a movie, a totally different structure of a scene, but something that still sort of works in this amorphous way that helps me uncover what how the logic of the movie that I started with got to the emotional places that it gets to. And I did this specifically with Don't Think Twice, because I think this is such a beautiful, funny, heartfelt, but also emotionally difficult film that forces a lot of different characters to deal with things like ambition and growing old without having succeeded in what you hoped to succeed, as well as what you're willing to set aside for family and what the ways you can hurt each other as a found family.
Wow. That is a very deep reading of that movie. And I quite like that film, but wow, the effort you put in taking apart the structure of Don't Think Twice is really impressive. This movie has a great cast. It's one of those that has so many wonderful performers in it, including Birbiglia himself. Kate Micucci, Keegan-Michael Key, of course, being the breakout star in this, which is interesting because, of course, he kind of was a breakout star. So it was well cast. Mm-hmm. And there's a woman in the film I just wanted to point out who's, I think she's got a bit part in this. Her name is Emily Skeggs, who is not a super well-known person these days, but she was in a movie last year that I saw and could not say enough good things about called Dinner in America. She's the co-lead of this film. It's so Dinner in America is just, I can't give a movie a higher recommendation, especially something this largely unknown. It's a little independent movie about a young woman who is very much on the spectrum, who is obsessed with a punk rocker who is basically hellbent on destroying himself. And they run into each other, and the whole movie is just them having the world's strangest romantic relationship. It kind of couldn't be a better little movie. And again, just an opportunity to do a shout out for a film no one's ever heard of. It's called Dinner in America. And it actually came out in 2020 or 2021, depending on where you were. But yeah, it's worth seeking out. Very special. And the actress, as I said, was in Don't Think Twice. Although, to be fair, I don't remember her in this movie. I just know she's in it.
But I'll put that on my list, too.
Yeah, but she is a new favorite of mine, having seen Dinner in America. I'm desperate to see another starring role from her at some point. She's very quirky. All right, let's move on to one more title before we run out of time for this segment. I see something on the horizon here on your list. Something, a high school movie, a very different kind of high school movie. It's called Brick. What can you tell me about Brick? I mean, I could say things about it, but I'm curious about your thoughts.
Brick is, to be honest, on this list because it's works its way into almost every type of scene that I try to write. It's just one of my favorite movies. It's when I had to rank my favorite for my Letterboxd profile, which is a social media app that allows you, it's all about movies. I think I put it at number one. Wow. It's Rian Johnson's first movie, who later went on to do Star Wars and Looper and Knives Out. And to be honest, it's still my favorite of his.
Me too.
I think the score, it's about a group of teenagers. It's the type of movie that sounds terrible.
Or pretentious. It sounds really pretentious. But...
Or like a bad episode of Saved by the Bell. Like it's about a group of teenagers and this sort of murder mystery that's set in this high school, but it's delivered as a noir movie with these heightened performances and very stylized dialogue and people that are fitting into these sort of noir types of like the femme fatale and the detective and things like that. Sounds awful, but it is so, to my taste, exceptionally plotted and scripted and shot. And I adore the music in it by Rian Johnson's brother, Nathan Johnson.
Yeah, it's great.
I come back to thinking about this movie so often whenever I'm presented with a problem in a script and think like, is there anything analogous to this that Brick did? And how did they solve this problem? Just to get the gears rolling. I could think about this movie endlessly.
Welcome back to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody, and today I am talking with cartoonist, author, writer, artist on several books, including The Chair's Hiatus and Incredible Doom, Mr. Matthew Bogart. Matthew, I wanted to bring up one thing about your work, which I find fascinating, is I really enjoy your cartooning style, and what struck me rereading some of it this week was I really like it when you draw, not backgrounds, but like empty rooms or an auditorium with no one in it except a character on a stage. And I realized there's this sort of haunting tone to a lot of these shots that does a lot more than just set up a location. So I just wanted to say, I like all of that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do think about that stuff a lot. One of the things that I enjoy most in the graphic novels that I read is when you is little touches that start to give you the experience of being there, which can be deceptively difficult in comics because so often different people read comics in different ways, but many people read them by just looking at the word balloons and letting their peripheral vision take in the pictures. And so it's easy to, even if you drew the most beautiful scene, for people to just not really feel like they're there, just picking it, pick up like, we're in a jungle. Okay. We're in a school or what have you. And I love to try when I can, when there's room, to force people to take in an environment. And one way you can do that is just by not giving them much else to look at. And I do that with environments and sound effects and any little thing that I think could get you to just take you into the moment, like a printer making a little noise that only printers in the 90s would make, or that feeling of like a big giant gymnasium with the way the light reflects off of the shiny floor and things. If I can capture that for a second, I feel like it just settles you in this place, and then you can get onto the drama.
I totally understand. It's just I found that there was a lot of stuff you did that was a lot more effective than most people's an establishing shot. Like, a lot of artists need to constantly show establishing shots, especially in adventure comics, where, well, here's a shot of the bank and here's a shot of the hero's headquarters. But they're very much there for me as placeholders of just not having to write a line that says, meanwhile, at the bank.
Right.
They don't give you much in terms of tone, but I gave you the example of the empty auditorium, which, if nothing else, is, wow, you really drew the hell out of that. It's a lot of little lines to establish no people. But there was another shot I'm reflecting on. I think it's somewhere in volume one of Incredible Doom, which is just a hallway shot of, I think some characters are in it, but there's in the foreground, there's the folding ladder coming down from an attic. And I just remember thinking, I don't know, it just put me in that place. There was a moment there. I just wanted single it out as something. Again, it's not every cartoonist who manages to get me in that tonal way that you do. So getting back to our main topic is we were talking about films that inspired you or led you down certain paths in the current storytelling that you're doing. Prior to the break, we had spoke about lots of movies. We talked about Moonrise Kingdom and Go and Don't Think Twice and several others. Why don't you give us one more, Matthew, before we run out of time?
Well, this one, I would be intrigued what people think about this movie if they come to it new, because it's All the Real Girls by directed by David Gordon Green. It was a movie that I just randomly came across on Netflix back when they would ship you discs. And I think it's an incredibly sort of sweet, down to earth romance that's very sort of gritty and earthy in a way that I haven't seen a lot of in other movies. I can't honestly guess whether people would take it in that way, because it's starring Zooey Deschanel and has and is the first film role of Danny McBride.
Mm-hmm. They're both babies in this, by the way.
Yes. And I watched this back when I think I might have seen Zooey Deschanel in Almost Famous. I can't remember the chronology of that. But, and you know, no one had ever seen Danny McBride. And so I was still entirely able to see these people as these characters, as opposed to Zooey Deschanel and Danny McBride. And so I don't know how people would come to it now, but there's a moment in this movie that I thought about all the time when writing Incredible Doom. And it's a romance between these two characters that are both very flawed, and they're in bed together, and the male protagonist discovers a scar on Zooey Deschanel's stomach, and she tells this story about how this was from this boating accident, and how this scar is very difficult for her. It's like a real source of trauma, and that she is very sensitive about it. And she is sort of opening up to him to let him into her world in this way that she is comfortable talking about this thing with him. And then as the story progresses, things go poorly. They end up breaking up in a very sort of emotionally traumatic way. And he's at a bar and he's drinking and he's trying to deal with these forces in himself that might have caused the relationship to go bad, might have caused other relationships to go bad. And she walks in the bar with a friend and she's wearing a cutoff t-shirt with just this scar exposed to everyone, where previously she'd always kept it covered up because she was ashamed. And he takes this as this betrayal that it just hurts him so badly. And the thing I love about this moment is, at least for me, being a guy who's sort of been trained to indulge this sort of sense, I felt, oh, I get why this is a betrayal. But then also I thought, you realize, like, but of course this shouldn't be. She's allowed to wear like whatever clothes she feels like. This is actually a moment of like, oh, great, she's feeling more comfortable with herself. But at the same time, it guides you into his feeling of like, this is the heart. This is so difficult for me to take that my partner, this special thing that we shared, is now no longer special between us. And I love trying to capture that complexity in the things that I write, where people can hurt each other in ways that aren't even really fair. That's not even appropriate in some ways to be hurt like this, but also to feel hurt by something like this, but also the drama can walk you through it in a way that makes you understand why someone might react this way. Anyway, that's a moment that Jesse and I talked a lot about. It's like, how can we write something that rides this line?
I mean, that's an absolutely perfect reading of that movie and how it might influence someone's work. I completely understand it. I also have zero recollection of everything you just said. And that's amazing to me because I think I last saw All the Real Girls in 2003. So it's been a bit, but it is the way you describe that entire character plot point arc is so precise. It makes me think this movie is so much better than I must have at the time. It's a great story point, and I fully understand the influence there. What's amazing about this movie, All the Real Girls, of course, is David Gordon Green, who went on to make more dramas and some of the dumbest comedies. And I don't mean that as an insult, but incredibly stupid, intentionally stupid films like Pineapple Express and The Sitter with Jonah Hill. And these are just junk films. I mean, they're totally enjoyable, but it's hard to imagine it's the same person who has also ultimately gone on to do 3 Halloween reboot horror exploitation films. He has a wonderful cinematic eye, but he points it in the strangest directions, David Gordon Green. I mean, anyone who's seen his first movie, George Washington, is, I cannot believe the same human being who, in the same reality, made George Washington would go on to make Halloween Kills, which I absolutely loved. But wow, is that movie trash in the best way.
Yeah, I agree. I love the way he, in a way, refuses to get pinned down, and another way just has the freedom to explore whatever seems to be getting him excited. Whether it results in the best movie or not, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, but I love following his work. I think
so do I.
it's fantastic.
Tonally and visually, his films are superb.
Yeah.
Even a movie like The Sitter is so gorgeous looking. And you just keep saying, but it's so dumb. Wow. I cannot believe you're standing behind the camera right now making this work so well.
there's another one to throw in on there, which would if you think you might not be able to get behind Zooey Deschanel or remove yourself from that process, Prince Avalanche is one that I would recommend. Absolutely. I think it's on Netflix.
Yeah, and Joe as well with Nick Cage. Yes. These are all so different, yet you can vaguely tell the same hand is guiding them. A fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love directors whose careers are different all the way through. An excellent example would be Mark Forster, who directed Monsters Ball and a bad James Bond movie, arguably a bad James Bond film, but also so many strange movies that don't feel like they're by the same person, yet are all really well-made and interesting. The last thing I want to touch on with All the Real Girls is, I could talk about that for 10 more minutes, but is it opens on a static shot, which can be brilliant or death for a movie, which is two people holding each other with a background, a distance background. I think they're outside and you can see into the distance and they're just holding each other for a long time and begin speaking. And it is an absolutely mesmerizing shot, the kind that makes me go, I could make movies. I could just point a camera at two people and not have them move and make it this good and then go, no, feel like maybe I can't do what you're doing in this moment. It's really something. I don't know if he repeats that shot later in the film, but he might.
Am I remember correctly that it opens with also like a Will Oldham song? I remember that might be the end credits. There's a hauntingly beautiful Will Oldham song in that movie too.
I'm afraid my 19 year old memory of this is a little faded for specifically which musician's pieces are on the soundtrack. Yeah. I mean, and I would absolutely say that All the Real Girls is a flawed but fascinating film. And that's my favorite stuff to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's beautiful. It was some wonderful performances, as I remember it. I if people do check it out, hit me up on Twitter and tell me what you think, because I would love to see what this looks like to people after, you know, Vice Principals and New Girl and things like that. Like, how do people take that movie?
Yeah, we never even got into his TV work, of course, which is also crazy.
Yes.
Matthew, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show today. I absolutely love your work. The Chairs Hiatus graphic novel and the two volumes of Incredible Doom are now available through Harper Alley, a division of HarperCollins. I like saying it because that's a real company. And when you get signed really by something like that, you know you've made it.
Oh.
Or at least we can pretend. Any final thoughts as we run through the last few seconds of our show here, Matthew?
No, I mean, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. I love the excuse to talk about movies.
Once again in the world of 1,200 feelings, all in electric lights, we see what we can. And I have been